Hello and welcome.
Hang on, hang on.
Welcome to our podcast. I'm Jeremy Wall.
I'm not, never have been, and never will be Jeremy Wall, but I'm Vince Staden.
So, what have we got on tonight's show?
Right, on tonight's eighth podcast. Can you believe that?
Yeah, and the first one of the new year.
Yeah, first one of 2018, and it's 8 o'clock-ish on the 8th as we record this.
Yeah.
So, all the 8ths. we'll be looking at Betty Boo. Remember Betty Boo?
I do, yeah.
Betty Boo and the kind of weird pop star personas that people take on in order to become pop stars for some reason. We'll be talking about a bit about that.
Yeah, and I can also see that we're going to be talking about the swinging 60s and in particular the dark side of the swinging 60s.
The dark, horrible side of the swinging 60s where everything went wrong. Altamont.
Yeah,
all that kind of stuff. The Manson murders.
Yeah.
All
of that, yeah.
Stevie Wonder. You like Stevie Wonder and Nick Drake. I don't think they ever worked together, did they? Stevie Wonder and Nick Drake. We'll be talking a little bit about them for Stevie Wonder and Nick Drake fans out there.
And their undisputed genius.
Well, is it undisputed? I'm disputing it. the weird thing about sightseeing, when you go and look at various things, you know, from pop or TV or film history or something, where you go and visit a place that's famous for something else. Like the Beatles have taken over Liverpool as a sort of tourist attraction.
Yeah.
We've done that a few times, haven't we?
We have done that, yeah.
And we've done a few other things. We'll be talking a little bit about that. Speaking of the Beatles, we'll do a little bit on the White Album because we've got one of their songs. Actually, the White Album would tie into that dark, horrible side of the 1960s.
Wouldn't and also as well, discussed. I mean, It's quite appropriate as well because it's the 50th anniversary of the White Album this year.
It's the 50 years. Wow. And along the way, we're going to try and form a supergroup. Now, a supergroup, as far as I'm aware, is this kind of formed together of people who were famous for being either famous artists in their own right or famous, you know, people in other groups. Eric Clapton and Cream with Ginger Baker.
Oh, yeah.
They're both famous for being in other things, weren't they? The Yardbirds and what was Ginger Baker?
Ginger Baker was in Cream.
Yeah. But that was a supergroup, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, it was, yeah. I mean,
why was Ginger Baker in it?
Him and Jack Bruce were both in the Graham Bond organisation, who were like a sort of rhythm and blues, big rhythm and blues band. You know, certainly big on the sort of on the live scene, you know,
and
made a few records, and then the two of them sort of transferred with Clapton, who came from he went from the Yardbirds to John Mayall's Blues Breakers,
right,
and then from John Mayall's Blues Breakers he formed Cream with Baker and Bruce,
right, not Ken Bruce. No. Okay, yeah, so we're going to be trying to form our own supergroup, possibly with Ken Bruce. Maybe he could be in it.
I think he's a drummer. Is he a drummer?
Ken Bruce.
I think he could be.
Let's find out. Let's get a hold of him on Twitter. But before we do any of that, let's have our first song, which I've chosen. And it's Betty Boo. You remember Betty Boo from the 90s?
I do.
Doing the Do.
Impressed and I'm older. Cooking cold, getting colder, and at the very same time
Right, so Betty Boo, Doing the Do, contains the brilliant lyric, 'cause I'm hot and sizzly, put you in the mood, someone like you puts me off my food.
Right, yeah. Okay.
So I've been listening to that over the last couple of days. I think I've heard more Betty Boo than I have in the rest of my life. And to be honest, I think that's enough. But I do like that. It's cheeky, it's funny, it's catchy rap pop from, when was it, 1990, something like that?
It's probably very early 90s, I would have thought, yeah.
And she had a second single called Where Are You Baby? Which is probably better than that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't remember it as much as this one.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So Betty Boo is not... That's not who she is. Her real name's Alison somebody. I'll look it up in a second.
Yeah.
And she's basically a songwriter.
Yeah.
She had a big collaboration with people called the Beat Masters.
Oh, yeah.
And then formed around sort of persona with Betty Boo and did well with that.
Yeah.
Briefly. And then settled down to write hits for other people.
Yeah.
There are quite a lot of people who do that, aren't there? Who have short pop careers.
Yeah.
Then go on to write hits for other artists.
Yeah, I mean, there's Kathy Dennis.
Kathy Dennis. Now, I can't remember anything Kathy Dennis did.
She had a couple of hits in the late 80s, I think. Right. But she went on to write... I'm pretty certain she wrote that... The Kylie Minogue smash, I can't get you out of my head.
That is a corker of a song to write.
In collaboration with the guy who used to be the guitarist in the glam rock band Mud.
Really?
Yeah, he wrote he wrote songs with her as well, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, Alison, whatever her name is, Clarkson, I think it might have been. who is Betty Boo, wrote Hearsay's hit...
Pure and simple,
yeah.
Right, okay, yeah.
Smash hit.
The start of the dreaded sort of reality TV.
The Simon Cowell era, of horror.
So the whole point of this segment actually is to do with sort of...
Well, before we talk about that,
yes.
You jump the gun here, my friend.
Oh, right, yeah.
You have to do your job.
Oh, right, okay.
What is your job? Let's remind anybody who hasn't heard us for a while.
Or okay.
Indeed, new listeners. From Petaluma. Hello.
So, we've got a... the premise of the show is that I rather sort of arrogantly rate the artists we play.
He has no experience, no authority, nobody gave him this. He just took it upon himself one day to rate everybody.
But
nobody has yet tried to stop him. I can't understand why.
So we've got a badly made board, which has the Beatles up on high. They're basically unassailable. And below that, we've got a first rate, second rate, third rate, and fourth rate. And every time I rate an artist, we put them in the appropriate column. So, coming back...
Yeah, well, let's ask the question then. Betty Boo, first rate, second rate, third rate, or fourth rate?
Betty Boo, I'd have to put her third rate.
Third rate. I will mark that down.
Yeah. Really, I mean, you know, it was quite sort of faddish sort of stuff. There wasn't any sort of longevity in that career.
Oh, no, a very short-lived career.
Yeah, and, you know, in that sort of late 80s, early 90s period where it was kind of, there was a lot of that sort of rap light or whatever, rap pop about, you know.
Yeah.
Salt and Pepper.
Yes, they were funny.
Oh, God, I can't think what they're called. Oh, the Cookie Crew.
Oh, yeah, the Cookie Crew.
And that sort of stuff. So it was very much of the time, I would say. And but nevertheless, I mean, if she wrote those songs, I mean, she obviously had an ability to write. And like you said, that's what she does now. But
Doing the Do reached number 7 in 1990.
1990, right.
And the follow-up, Where Are You Baby, got to number 3 in, the same year. So that was basically it for her career.
Yeah.
As Betty Boo, but obviously she continues to be involved in the industry as a songwriter.
But so if we're judging, you know, the creation of Betty Boo, I would have to put her as third rate.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. I'm not going to argue with that. I like Betty Boo. I thought she was engaging, funny, kind of arty in that way, just riffing on stuff from the Avengers of appeal, Betty Boop, the cartoon character, that kind of sex pot imagery, but also with the rap influence, without any taking any of it very seriously, but at the same time being quite credible.
It's almost very much like Nana Cherry.
I don't know enough about Nina Cherry to actually...
What's that?
Buffalo Girls?
Buffalo Stance.
Buffalo Stance.
Yeah, right. But, it's a pity she didn't make a record with Betty Boothroyd. No, I'd have bought that.
I think I would have. I think everybody would have. That would be fantastic. Let's put that out there. If you're listening, Alison.
we want you to write...
Is she still alive, Betty Boothroyd?
Well, I don't know.
Well... Let's hope so. Did anybody actually ever find out what the do is, by the way, when you're doing the do? What is it?
I don't know.
Anything to do with Scooby? Anyway, Alison Clarkson became Betty Boo for the purposes of a pop career. And she follows on a lineage of people who do the same thing, almost like actors taking on a role.
Yeah.
There's Alvin Stardust.
Yes.
Who's the prime mover in this, I think. Who was two people at once. He was Shane Fenton.
He was Shane Fenton in the 60s.
Yes.
Shane Fenton and the Fentones.
Right.
And they had a hit, I think, with a track called I'm a Moody Guy.
Right.
In about 63, I think. 62, 63.
I think I remember that vaguely.
And then he's like another one of these sort of characters. I mean, I doubt... You know, I feel sort of, you know, obliged to mention Gary Glitter.
Yes.
Gary Glitter is from that, you know, he made records in the 60s as under the name Paul, under his own name, Paul Gadd, under another name, Paul Raven.
Really?
And then he teamed up with Mike Leander and formed the sort of Gary Glitter persona.
Right.
And had, you know, a lot of success in the early mid-70s.
So there's a weird thing going on where they're pretending to be a pop star and then having pop hits with that persona.
Yeah.
So they're not actually being themselves. They're almost taking on... And it's not like someone like Sting being Sting or Elvis being Elvis. It's different from that, isn't it? It's almost like a theatrical role they take on, which is very odd. So Alvin Stardust,
Gary Glitter,
who else was there?
Just trying to think.
In the 60s there were loads of people who were given strange persona names and things by their management.
Yes.
And Billy Fury was probably something like Joe Lumpenthorpe from Grimsby suddenly becomes...
Well, that whole stable of artists, you know, the Larry Pines stable, which kind of sort of preceded the Beatles era.
Yeah.
And there were people like sort of Vince Eager.
Vince Eager?
Yeah, which I think you should be called.
I think I should.
Billy Fury.
You would never be called Jeremy Wall if you were a pop star.
No.
That would just not fly, would it?
No. I think we've spoken about this in the past. Yes. And I was thinking of calling myself Tony Wallace.
Tony Wallace.
But even that's a bit, that's rubbish.
No, that is a double glazing salesman, isn't it?
Yeah, so Billy Fury, Vince Eager, Marty Wilde.
Marty Wilde, yes.
They were all part of that stable, you know.
Yeah.
So they
What about Adam Ant? I think he's a bit like that. He's not Adam Ant, is he? That's not his real name, is it?
Stuart Goddard.
Oh. It'd be funny if it was. Adam Ant. That'd be brilliant if they had, you know, assemblies. Ant... So Stuart Goddard,
yes,
becomes Adam Ant,
yes,
and the whole Wild Frontier makeup and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
very odd. So what about Gary Numan? Is he actually Gary Numan?
Gary Webb.
Ah, so he's another one.
Yeah,
he's not really some kind of robotic.
No.
Psychopath.
No.
Is he?
But how do you think it differs from, you know, you said like, oh, Elvis is obviously Elvis's name, so he doesn't qualify, but how is Sting different to, say, Alvin Stardust? How do you think?
Well, because he's pretty much who he is, apart from when he's on stage, you know, but he's not making public appearances in a costume.
No.
And in a big production doing skits and things. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's, I mean, Betty Boo, for example, if she came on stage, would be Betty Boo.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be... I know Gordon, what's his name? Sumner,
yeah.
Doesn't go on stage as Gordon Sumner, he goes on stage as Sting.
Yes.
But that's, there is a difference, I think.
Yeah.
And I think even you can make a demarcation with someone like Boy George.
Mm.
He's pretty much Boy George all the time, even though that's not who he is. I can't remember his name now.
George O'Dowd.
But Alvin Stardust, Gary Glitter, Adam Ant, and Betty Boo. Aren't that those people? They
inhabit those names, and then it allows them to be something larger than life. Certainly
larger than life.
Certainly in the case of Gary Glitter, you know.
Yeah,
and
I always have to wince whenever we say the name Gary Glitter because of the horrible connotations that name now it brings up.
But you know, I'm obviously not condoning the whole Gary Glitter story.
No. Let's go out of a way to make that very clear.
But in terms of musical output and popularity in the 70s, he did make some good records. So, you know, therefore we discuss him.
Well, I suppose you have to separate the product from the production, don't you? Like sausages, in a way. The art is separate from the artist.
Yes, yeah.
So... Gary Glitter's records, I'm the Leader of the Gang and all that,
are
different from Paul Gadd's Hideous Crimes.
Yeah.
You have to separate the two. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to listen to Wagner, would you?
No.
Or, you know, even John Lennon was quite unpleasant.
So there's a great... there's an artist called Luke Haynes who was
in the Auteurs.
He was in the Auteurs and then now solo. And he's one of my favourite artists, you know.
Yeah.
And on one of his records, he... He did a song called Bad Reputation. It's a song basically about how the Glitter Band are tied with the same brush as Gary Glitter, and people can't work out that they are nothing to do with that.
No, they're completely different from him, the individual who did those things. Yeah. I understand. That might be one of your Jeremy Recommend songs then, is it?
It's Bad Reputation. Yeah.
Bad Reputation by Luke Haynes.
Luke Haynes.
And not the Auteurs.
Not the Auteurs, Luke Haynes. It's a solo off a solo album from 2006.
Okay, right. So let's move swiftly on because we have an itinerary to stick to. We play five songs, one of which is the Beatles, isn't it?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And the next up is a track that you've chosen. So we usually alternate songs. I chose Betty Boo. I just want to make it clear that I chose Betty Boo.
Right.
I want to get all the credibility that comes my way for that. Who's next? What have you chosen?
Well, probably one of the sort of all-time great sort of manufactured bands, the Monkees.
The Monkees. Hey.
All men must have someone never take advantage of the love bright as the sun. Someone to understand them, and you just may be the one. All men must have someone who never take for granted all the pleasures and the fun. Someone to stand beside them, and you just may be the one. I saw when you walked by, the love light in your eyes, I knew I must try to win.
Okay, so that was You Just May Be the One by the Monkees, a track off their third album, Headquarters. It was written by Mike Nesmith and sung primarily by Mike Nesmith, who you might know from sort of further his other bands, the First National Band that he formed in the early in the early 1970s, and then he went on and had a solo hit as well called Rio.
Really? I don't know that at all.
No. Anyway, so yeah, like I said before the track, the Monkees are probably the sort of the eminent manufactured band. In fact, you know, they were called the Prefab Four, and they sort of Nesmith and Peter Tork came from sort of musical backgrounds. Mm. Davy Jones came from sort of an acting stroke sort of musical sort.
He
of
was
background.
The Armful Dodger. On stage and everything.
I think he was, yeah. And Mickey Dolenz came from an acting background. He was in an American show called Circus Boy.
Right.
As a kid.
So the conceit was they got these four chaps together.
Yeah.
And made a sitcom.
Yes.
In which they're trying to be a pop band.
Yeah, living together in a house, yeah.
Living together in a house. Basically the setup from A Hard Day's Night and Help.
Yes.
And they actually do become a pop band, because as the time progresses, they start writing their own stuff.
They do.
And have some wonderful, wonderful songs.
So initially, you know, they're sort of adding vocals to sort of session musician performances on the first few records.
And are they miming? When they're playing, on a studio set, in a sitcom performance, when they break into song.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know.
To the playback or something.
Yeah, yeah. But... By the time of that album, that third album, it's an album called Headquarters.
Yeah.
They'd kind of wrestled creative control away from their original management, because they felt that they wanted to play.
And this is quite a short space of time, because we're only talking about a year or 18 months into...
Yeah, I mean, Monkees started in the pro TV programme started in 66, I think.
Yeah.
And then they had a massive hit in early 1967 with I'm a Believer.
Yeah.
Which hit number one in UK as well. So Headquarters, the third album, was out in 1967, and they played everything on it. So the sort of non-musicians became musicians. Mickey Dolenz sort of learned how to play drums, basically.
Really?
And sort of played on the tracks. Wow. On the album. By the time of their fourth album, which...
I mean, they are good as a band.
They are good.
You wouldn't have known that is a very young musicians learning their...
No, exactly, yeah.
Because as songwriters, as singers, as guitarists, they're good.
Yeah, I mean, Mike Nesmith wrote sort of the original type of material.
Yeah.
He wrote some really good tracks. I'm pretty certain he wrote... there's another track, I believe, on Headquarters called Sunny Girlfriend.
Right.
That's a Jeremy Recommends, I think.
Okay. Right.
And that's a Mike Nesmith song. That's another cracking song.
Right.
Yeah, so by the time of their fourth album, which is Pisces, Capricorn, Jones, and a Pisces, Capricorn, Aquarius, and Jones.
Right.
The fourth album, they've reverted to session musicians again.
Ah, okay.
But that is a really strong album. In fact, that's my favourite album by the Monkees.
And they made a very weird psychedelic film called Head.
They did.
Jack Nicholson.
That's it, yeah.
Which is one of the key defining movies of that psychedelic,
yeah,
strange period just before Easy Rider.
Yeah, I think the same sort of production team were involved in that.
Right.
A guy called Bob Rafelson.
Okay, yeah.
And another guy, they were the sort of the production team.
So they were quite into the counterculture of 1960s hippiedom and free expression.
Yeah, very much so. They're part of that Laurel Canyon set.
Yeah.
And Mickey Dolenz, you know, you'd see Mickey Dolenz at things like the Monterey Pop Festival, sort of hobnobbing with the sort of main players, you know.
Right, okay. Yeah.
And that sort of thing. So they were kind of accepted.
Yeah.
But they did get a lot of flack, I think, for sort of being this manufactured band.
Yeah.
And I think
did they ever meet the Beatles?
Yeah. There's pictures of them with the Beatles.
Right.
They came to sort of England. They came to England to sort of I think in early 67 to sort of promote I'm a Believer, because I'm a Believer was a hit in the early part of 1967.
Right.
But
and what did the Beatles think of the Monkees?
I'm not entirely sure. I think John, you know, they were accepting of them.
Mm.
They sort of accepted them for what they were, you know.
Yeah.
I think the backlash was more an American thing amongst the other bands, you know, that sort of their, you know, their contemporaries.
Okay.
But, yeah, they're a perfect example of sort of putting together a product.
Yeah.
And, but, of course...
A kind of pop designed by a committee that absolutely works.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. I mean, after Pisces, after the fourth album, Pisces, Capricorn, Aquarius, and Jones, it started to become sort of diminishing returns. Really,
right.
I think that the series got dropped. They made Head, which was like a real head scratcher for people who had like watched the Monkees TV series. And then gradually members left, and they were left as a three of them, and then two of them, and then that was that.
Right.
Until the sort of the reunions later on in the '80s and the '90s, but
the inevitable reunions. Happen.
Yeah. But a cracking band, underrated, I think.
Well, we might as well get on with it then. So the Monkees.
First rate.
I thought you might say that.
Yeah.
Mark them down on the board. First rate for the Monkees.
I mean, there are a lot, there's undoubtedly filler material on the first couple of albums, but there are one or two, gems, and I have to say the fourth album is well worth checking out. It's pretty consistent right the way through. It's got songs written by people like Harry Nilsson on there.
Wow.
And Neil Diamond. I think Neil Diamond writes another song on there. He certainly wrote a couple of... He wrote I'm a Believer.
He wrote I'm a Believer.
And he also wrote A Little Bit Me, A Little Bit You.
Oh, okay, yeah.
As well, which were both recorded. Yeah. But a lot of the top songwriters of the day wrote for the Monkees,
Yeah.
And Harry Nilsson being one of them. So, wow. Yeah.
I must say that the TV series isn't very funny.
No.
It's that scattery, sort of zany, anything goes kind of people popping up out of all directions and saying a zinger, and then someone falling over in a heap of clothes as one of them mournfully says, "We can never get anything done around here," kind of thing.
Yeah.
That the Goodies lampooned a lot, very Britishly. But that doesn't mean that the Monkees were, I don't think they wrote the shows. They couldn't have had much input into the material, so that's not their fault.
No.
And it was very popular with young people. It was. I remember watching it in the early 80s when it was repeated on BBC Two. Do you remember that?
I certainly remember watching it on repeat, yeah.
And it was, I think there was the Banana Splits afterwards.
Oh, yeah.
It was always funnier.
Yeah, yeah.
Banana Splits.
That always reminds me of Summer Holidays.
Right. Yeah, it would have been the Summer Holidays.
For those of you who are listening to this in the UK, you'll know of a certain age, you'll know programmes like Why Don't You?
I think you're being a bit optimistic there.
Why
Don't You? Written by Russell T. Davis.
Was it?
Yeah, and presented by him in the later years.
What?
Why Don't You is his first big thing, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
How old's Russell T. Davis then?
He's a bit older than us. He's in his 50s now.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So he was a presenter on the show?
Yeah. Well, actually, he didn't intend to be, but his first ever narrative thing he ever got on television was to turn Why Don't You, which is basically a magazine-type show of people doing little bits of videotape here and there of people doing things, into a narrative where he had a story going through it. And this is in his later years, because he was part of the cartoonists who were behind it as well.
Right, okay.
Russell T. Davis being an accomplished cartoonist.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Right. Why don't you turn off your TV set and go and do something less boring instead?
Indeed, yeah.
Was that essentially
made in Wales, you see?
Oh, right, okay.
Which is where Swansea lad Russell T. Davis was from.
Here we come, walking down the street. We get the funniest looks from everyone we meet. Hey, hey, we're the Monkees, and people say we're monkeying around. We're too busy singing to put anybody down.
One banana, two banana, three banana, four. Four bananas make a bunch of something anymore. Over hill and highway the banana buggies go. Coming up to bring you the banana split show.
This is BBC One. And now, plenty of ideas for things to do as we join the Cardiff team who say, why don't you?
We're the young generation, and we've got something to say.
There you go.
Anyway, we've veered well off the beaten path there. Well, we want to talk a little bit about the horrible, weird associations that the Monkees had,
yes,
and the Beach Boys,
yes,
with the dark side of the 60s and the Manson family, and where the 60s died, really, in a sort of bloody, brutal way. So that's a cheery thing to start the year with. So explain a little bit about how Charles Manson had any connection with the Monkees and the Beach Boys.
Manson was kind of sort of in the Laurel Canyon sort of Hollywood set.
Right. Now Manson has spent most of his life in prison.
He did,
correctional,
yeah,
facilities, but gravitated towards misfits and...
Yeah, I think he gravitated initially to, when he got released, he initially went to San Francisco.
Right. Into Haight-Ashbury.
Yeah, and then sort of started gathering his sort of people together, and then sort of headed down to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
But sort of took up residence on the outskirts, out in the sort of...
in a ranch, I think.
Yeah, Spahn Ranch, yeah. I think it is, yeah.
Sort of an old cowboy set used by ranchers and things.
But he was kind of a frustrated musician himself.
Now, there are bootlegs of his songs.
Yeah.
Produced by Dennis Wilson?
Well, there's demos of his songs, one called... Cease to Exist, which was actually recorded under a different name, right. Different name by the Beach Boys. So they actually did record
The Beach Boys did actually record a Charles Manson song,
but under.
And what
a
about the Monkees? How did they get involved in all this?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure of the connection between the Monkees. I guess the Monkees were in the sort of circles of the Beach Boys and all those people, and Manson was definitely in the circle of sort of Dennis Wilson, and the Byrds, and people like Terry Melcher,
right,
who's a Doris Day's son, who was a producer, used to produce the Byrds.
A weird fact I found out, you know, the guy who played Grandpa Vampire in the Munsters, an actor called Al Lewis,
right? Okay.
Remember the Munsters?
Yes,
there's a vampire figure,
yes,
Grandpa,
right? Yeah,
actor Al Lewis. He had Manson babysit his kids.
Oh, right, okay.
Unbelievable.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, so Manson felt that the world owed him a living, certainly the music business. And I believe that Dennis Wilson had a contact with Terry Melcher.
Yeah.
And there was like an insinuation that they might be interested in recording him, but it didn't come to fruition. So Melcher sort of feared for his life and sort of fled, basically.
Right.
And Dennis Wilson then started to try and sort of distance himself from Manson.
Right.
But then, of course, you know, you get into 1969, and Manson is sort of, in August 1969, you get all the sort of the start of the murders, so the Taylor-Bianca murders.
So Manson, who is a psychopath, there's no other way of putting it, was a kind of cult messianic figure to a group of very strange, deluded people who fell under his influence and murdered for him.
Yes.
To start what he called Helter Skelter, which is a coming race riot apocalypse.
Yeah.
God knows what, how people get into that kind of mindset. You have to be seriously ill, mentally ill.
I think the idea was to set white against black, and after sort of the apocalypse, then he would be in a position to sort of take control.
Mm. As the son of God. Because he saw himself as a new messiah, didn't he?
Right, okay, yeah.
And people followed him and butchered human beings in his name and then scrawled pigs and filth and helter skelter. Badly. Yeah. Why do murderers, psychotic murderers and their acolytes, never know how to spell properly? Maybe there will be classes.
Yeah.
Just so that when they do go, you know, sprawling messages in blood on walls, they get it right.
Yeah.
You know, maybe the guards from Life of Brian.
Oh, yeah,
admonish the Judean People's Front for bad spelling of their Latin.
Yes, yeah.
Should come along at murder crimes.
Yeah.
And say, no. How do you spell Helter? H-E-L. There's no A.
Yeah. So,
Then in the, this was 1969, then Woodstock was in 1969. We keep forgetting that. And at the end of the year, in December,
yeah.
the Rolling Stones, who were come under criticism for their ticket prices,
right.
were going to hold a free concert, which got moved around and moved around, and eventually ended up at a place called Altamont.
Yes. Altamont Speedway, I think.
Yeah, which is totally unsuited for this kind of event, but that was all they could do. And then at the last moment, conflicting reports of why the Hells Angels chapter of motorbike gangs were involved is security. They were offered $500 worth of free beer or something.
Oh, yeah.
To
yeah.
keep, basically keep order. But throughout the day, things got deeply, deeply unpleasant. And
there were a few support bands on, one of which was Jefferson Airplane. And
Santana, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And the lead singer of Jefferson Airplane got hit with a pool cue.
Yes.
As he went down to try and break up some trouble. And was knocked unconscious for a bit.
Yeah, and then got up and finished the set.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, the show must go on.
I think it was the Grateful Dead who refused to go on after they heard about that. They were on supposedly going to play. They didn't.
Yeah.
Crosby, Stills, Nash were there.
Right, okay.
And then obviously the Stones came on late.
Yes.
Apparently because Bill Wyman got in. He had to be flown in by helicopter or something, and he got there late.
Oh, right, okay.
Just as the sun was going down,
yeah,
and people had been drinking all day, and had been very bad tempers flaying, and then
they started to set with "Sympathy for the Devil," right?
Yes, which is probably not the best of choices, and they had to restart it several times. And then during I don't know which song it was, but someone was murdered by one of the Hells Angels.
Yeah.
A man pulled a gun out, apparently, yeah. and a Hells Angel stabbed him to death.
Yeah,
and it's all caught on film, on a film called Gimme Shelter.
I think his name was Meredith Hunter.
Meredith Hunter, that's right, yes. Yeah, but he was very high, and it could be that he wanted to shoot Mick Jagger. We don't know.
No, no. Let's face it, they didn't need sort of much of an invitation to sort of stir up trouble, really, I think.
The Stones.
The Hells Angels.
Oh, the Hells Angels, yeah, yeah.
yeah. Yeah,
it was by all accounts catastrophic day.
Yeah,
just people were injured. Obviously, there was a murder. There was a death later.
Yeah,
and it basically symbolised the death of the 1960s of the kind of hopeful hippie counterculture of peace and love
from 67 that had evaporated.
That had flowered.
Yeah,
and blossomed into something like a movement.
Yeah.
You have to remember that the 60s was very violent. You had the Vietnam War, you had all those political assassinations of...
and JFK 68, of course, was the sort of... probably the apogee of that.
Mm.
The
what?
Apogee.
The apogee.
Yeah?
Yeah, okay.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's just I've never heard that word spoken to me in a sentence before. Particularly by you.
Is that surprising?
No, not at all. No. 68 was the apogee of this has got to be our title, hasn't it? of political and social unrest in the 1960s.
Well, Martin Luther King was assassinated. Robert Kennedy was assassinated that year.
Is that the same year?
Wow. Yeah, 68, I think. Yeah.
And you had all the riots that were going on.
You had the American embassy in London. The riots around. Trying to think of the area square, Grosvenor Square.
Okay. Yeah.
In London.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it sort of turned, in 1968, it turned into sort of something a lot darker.
You also had loads of very dark political groups going on, like the Weathermen, or the Weather Underground.
Do they do It's Raining Men?
They should do, with Betty Boothroyd. isn't there a group called the Weathermen?
Possibly, yeah.
And
I'm hoping that's... Michael Fish and John Ketley.
John Ketley and Michael Fish, for anybody who's baffled by these references, are British television weathermen presenters, or were
yeah.
still around.
Yeah.
So the very violent time of the 60s, and obviously the flowering of this stuff led to occult figures being involved, and there was lots of embracing of different ideas and philosophies. Maoism became big.
Yeah.
So it all coalesced into something that is quite unpleasant and dark. We think of, I think, the 60s as kind of a hopeful, bright sunshine thing. I always think of Good Day Sunshine by the Beatles.
Oh, yeah.
And hippies, you know, in brilliant sunshine walking through fields. But, yeah. It, you know, it didn't end that way at all.
I mean, you know, this whole image that, you know, of the 60s and how sort of swinging, the swinging 60s. Mm. I mean, I'm pretty certain, you know, in sort of provincial towns, you know, it wasn't like
in
that.
In Swindon.
It wasn't like that
it
at all.
It wasn't like that in Swindon, was it?
You know, it's not, you know, and it's a sort of, I think I've said this to you before, you know, I sort of often crave to be in that time. Even though I wasn't born then, you know, you sort of see certainly sort of the whole Beatles, sort of Sgt. Pepper era, you know, and all that sort of footage and all that. You kind of, I get this sort of, you know, this longing to sort of be
a longing. That's a good word. Yeah, that's I get a very similar feeling. I get a kind of a kind of ache.
Yeah,
that I wanted to be part of that. I wanted to be there and experience that, and as if I was born in the wrong time.
Yeah, well, I always felt that as well. But I know if we were around in 1967, living where we live, I think we would be sadly.
Yeah, it would have passed us by a bit.
I think
free love and free expression and stuff like that. In Lockleys. We're not exactly that type of people, anyway. But anyway, we better move on. We've done our business of rating the Monkees.
Yes.
And what was the song you wanted to recommend from the Monkees?
The other song is a track called Sunny Girlfriend.
Sunny Girlfriend, I'll make a note of that. I'll move on then to... Sorry, you were going to say
something? I was just going to wrap up. Just going back slightly to what was said about Charles Manson, Helter Skelter and the Piggies and all that. That is often, you know... it's often been said that he was somehow influenced by sort of the White Album.
Yes, by the lyrics on the White Album,
you know.
He said something in court that, hey, I didn't write the songs, man.
Right, okay, yeah.
Meaning, you know, the lyrics are all there for everybody to see.
Yeah, of course, yeah. So, yeah, just wanted to raise that point.
No, it's a good point. And we are actually going to be playing a song from the White Album, not Helter Skelter.
No.
But a song from that deeply disturbing album later. But first, we've done the Monkees. It's got to be Stevie Wonder then.
Special place to go, but when I ask, will you be coming back soon? You don't know, never know. While I'm a man of many wishes, hope my premonition misses. But what I really feel, my eyes won't let me hide. They always start to cry, 'cause this time could mean goodbye. Staring in the mirror, very slowly picking me apart, trying to tell myself I had no reason with your heart.
Gorgeous, gorgeous song by Stevie Wonder called Lately, which is my second choice for today's podcast. It's my favourite Stevie Wonder song, I think. I remember hearing it when it came out in the UK in 1981.
Yeah.
Very strong memories of hearing it on the radio and thinking this was quite something lovely, you know, amidst all the pomp of 81's new romantics and things.
And in particular, Adam Ant.
Adam Ant. It was,
our two number ones that year. That was kind of
stomping around in a new frontier. A song like that is very underrated. I was doing a tiny bit of research on it, and barely anybody talks about it. There's hardly anything ever written about this. It's sort of one of those forgotten songs that's hugely underrated. I mean, he had some terrific songs. I've forgotten every single one of them. Apart Birthday, which was the same year from the same album, is one of those songs that actually has importance beyond itself, in that he was written to commemorate Martin Luther King.
Oh, happy birthday to you.
Yeah, yeah. And so it was part of an active campaign to get Martin Luther King's birthday commemorated as a national holiday.
Right, okay.
And 8 years later, it did. So that song in itself has a power beyond its you know, being a pop song. Lately was an album called on an album called Hotter Than July.
Yeah.
After his previous album had sort of tanked a bit.
Yeah.
And he was a bit fed up with Motown. And I think, is it called Tamla, the record label?
It was Tamla Motown,
right.
Yeah.
Which he felt weren't promoting him enough.
Yeah, I'm not sure what label he was on at that stage. Was he on Motown right the way through the 70s?
Yeah, I think so.
Right, okay.
And this spawned, I think that Happy Birthday was a number one hit for him, was it?
Not sure, not in this country,
right,
no.
Okay. Might have been in America.
Yeah.
And then he went on to have a hot streak, didn't he? I Just Called to Say I Love You in about 1984.
Yeah, yeah. That was a number one in the UK.
That was a number one, yeah. That was everywhere.
Yeah.
He did a collaboration with Macca.
Oh, Ebony and Ivory.
Ebony and Ivory.
Yeah. He had that hit as well with Part-Time Lover.
Part-Time Lover with, was it Phil Bailey?
No, that's Easy Lover.
That was
Easy Lover.
His own. That was Easy Lover with Phil Collins. So what were you doing? So let's talk a little bit about Stevie Wonder. What do you think of him? Is he first rate, I'm saying? What do you think?
Yeah, I think so, first rate.
So you're going to rate him first rate?
I am going to rate him first rate.
All right, good.
Based on, well, you know, he's just a great catalogue of music. And I know this is kind of like received wisdom,
yeah,
that, you know, all his 70s stuff is sort of genius.
Tell me what his 70s stuff is. I mean, he did the wonderful album Songs in the Key of Life.
Yes.
So what's on that everybody would know?
I've got a feeling that... is it Pastime Paradise?
Don't know that much.
I mean, you know, they lifted that for Coolio's...
Gangster's Paradise.
Yeah. Living in a Pastime Paradise. I'm sure it's called that.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's on that album.
Yeah.
He made an album called Talking Book.
Mm-hmm.
As well, and made an album called Inner Visions.
Okay.
And they're all in a sort of that clustered in that early 70s period.
Right.
But then he was involved in the soundtrack of a film about something like The Secret Life of Plants.
Yes, that's it. That was the album that tanked. You love all that, though. Every pop star should have that kind of weird thing happening with them.
The Sgt. Pepper movie with the Bee Gees.
We watched the Bee Gees do their Sgt. Pepper movie recently. I think we got more and more appalled with every minute, didn't we?
Although, I have to say, some of the Beach Boys... Bee Gees' performances of the Beatles songs
they were
good.
Definitely the best thing in the film, yeah.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that another time in more detail.
Yeah.
But the idea that we were talking earlier at the top of the show about forming a supergroup.
Yes.
I'm putting Stevie Wonder in it.
Really?
Whatever group we come up with, right, he's on piano, and maybe do a bit of songwriting. And, you know, he's got such a lovely voice, he can always take over some of the vocals on. So how would you not have a Stevie Wonder in your supergroup?
Well, I don't know. I was going to ask you about the parameters of this supergroup.
Well, what do you think they should be?
I mean, are they going to be a sort of... Are we going to have a set... Are we going to have a fluid membership?
Yeah, we can have anybody in it and out. They're fired. If you want to fire a few.
But there'd be like a sort of transfer window, like there is in...
there should probably, yeah.
Supergroup transfer window.
Yes. Stevie Wonder's out. And,
Stevie Wonder's out, yeah.
And, Betty Boo's in. So I'm saying our supergroup, which we don't have a name for yet.
No.
Maybe just the overrated group or something.
Yeah.
With Stevie Wonder, he's there on piano. He does play the piano, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure he does.
Amongst other things.
Yeah. So he's on piano in the corner there.
Yeah. He's a useful drummer as well.
Is he a drummer as well?
Well,
I think we probably want a better drummer.
Yeah. Who are you thinking on drums?
I don't know. I don't know that many. John Bonham from Led Zeppelin and Phil Collins and...
Well, we could...
Nick Mason from Pink Floyd.
I know you've picked Stevie Wonder. But,
yeah, we're having Stevie Wonder.
Yeah.
I'm adamant.
But,
I'm adamant.
With regards to the supergroup, I kind of had it in my head that we were going to pick some unsung.
We could indeed. I don't mind picking some unsungs.
Yeah.
But I just want Stevie Wonder in my supergroup.
Okay.
Right.
That's fair enough.
Put my foot there.
Perhaps we could both have a supergroup.
Wow, what? In competition with each other?
Going out under the same name.
That'd be brilliant. Rival supergroups playing on the same night. Fine. All right, then you have your supergroup and I'll have my supergroup.
So you've picked a keyboardist.
I'm going to pick all the heavy hitters who are going to bring in the crowds. You know that. And leave your bunch of nobodies to languish in obscurity.
So, piano players. That's quite a... Unsung piano player. I kind of want my supergroup to be an unsung.
Right, so you're not going to pick Billy Joel?
No.
Right.
Who could I pick?
Excellent. That means he's free for me when Stevie Wonder starts pissing me off.
And the transfer window opens. Yeah.
Stevie started out. No, man, I told you not to play that. Right, you're out. And in comes Billy Joel. Joel is apparently very irritating, so... I might not get on with him very well.
Could he be added to our other...
Yes, well, the top... Yes. Well, I'll do a bit of research and find out. Because, you know, I may be considering him as a replacement for Stevie Wonder. You haven't picked anybody yet.
So I know, yeah. I'll have to come back for my keyboard choice.
Right, while you think then...
Yeah.
What are all the supergroups, I was going to ask you? So I know of Arcadia, which was someone from Duran Duran.
I think you were thinking of the Power Station.
No, Power Station's another one. And so the Power Station had, who was in Power Station?
Robert Palmer,
yeah.
I think the drummer from Chic.
Right.
Tony Thompson, is it?
Okay.
And two members of Duran Duran, I think. John
really?
Taylor.
Well, I will look that up because I'm pretty sure there was a band called Arcadia who also had Duran Duran involvement with Queen, I think. So
really?
I'm thinking. And then there was also they had a hit with Get It On, didn't they? Power Station.
Power Station did a terrible, terrible version.
Robert Palmer, though, he's got a great voice. Who else was there? There was
Asia.
Yeah. Were they a supergroup, really?
Yeah, they were. Made up of members from Yes and...
All right.
Another... I can't think who was in it, but it was definitely a supergroup.
Did they have a hit with anything?
Not that I know of, no. No.
Arcadia were a new wave British supergroup formed in 1985 by Simon Le Bon, Nick Rhodes and Roger Taylor of Duran Duran.
Yeah.
As a side project.
Right.
So they certainly did, yeah.
Yeah, they weren't with any. They were just a kind of spin-off as opposed to a supergroup.
I don't know if that actually counts as a supergroup or not. Electronic were a supergroup of the guy from the Smiths, Johnny Marr, I think, with the guy from New Order.
Bernard Sumner.
Bernard Sumner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. What, Johnny Marr and Bernard Sumner?
Yeah, Electronic.
Electronic, okay.
Yeah, they had really good a hit with Getting Away With It, which is one of my choices for one of the podcasts one day.
All right, okay. Yeah. I'm trying to think of supergroups. Well, you mentioned Cream, didn't you?
Yeah, Cream. Yeah. The supergroup, weren't they?
Yeah, really. That's the start of it, isn't it?
Mm.
I'm trying to think of 70s supergroups. Well, I'm going to jump straight to My Guitarist.
Oh, all right.
And My Guitarist is going to be Bill Nelson.
Who the hell's Bill Nelson?
He was the singer, songwriter, prime mover and guitarist from a band in the 70s called Bebop Deluxe.
All right, yeah.
And he's one of the sort of great sort of 70s guitarists.
Oh. Okay.
It was a toss up between him and a guy called Zal Clemenson.
Oh, I know Zal Clemenson. He's Scottish.
Yeah.
And, was he in the Alan Parsons Project?
No, the Sensational Alex Harvey Band.
The Alex Harvey Band, yeah, of course they were. Okay, then, I've got a few. Blind Faith are a supergroup.
Oh, that's a classic.
Yeah.
So that's Ginger Baker.
Yeah.
Clapton. Steve Winwood.
Stevie Winwood and
Rick
Guy,
Rick,
yeah, well done, yeah.
Rick Wreck came from a band called The Family.
Yes. The Byrds are apparently a supergroup. Coalition of Crosby, Stills and Nash is another early example, given the six of their... Oh, they were a supergroup, not the Byrds.
Crosby, Stills and Nash.
Because one of them come from Buffalo Springfield.
Yeah, Stephen Stills. Yeah.
Young is in Buffalo Springfield as well.
Yeah.
And Nash and Crosby were in the Byrds. No, Nash wasn't. He was in the Hollies.
He was in the Hollies. Yeah. Crosby's from the Byrds.
Oh, God, it's all a bit confusing, isn't it? Yeah, I'm tempted to have Nash in my group just to throw him out.
So you could get him to commit to your group,
yeah,
and move his operations over to the UK,
from Los Angeles to Totterdown, and then say, "Nah, change your mind, mate."
Actually, from Los Angeles to Totterdown, that could be a title of the show.
Well, there we go.
Yeah,
excellent.
Yeah.
So just to wrap this bit up, then my supergroup so far consists of Stevie Wonder on piano.
Yeah.
And Graham Nash, not in the band, but with the invitation, when he turns up, he's out again. And who is yours?
So far, I've picked a guitarist, and that is Bill Nelson.
Bill Nelson.
Yeah.
Let's have one of the recommends, so we can actually hear him in action.
Okay, Bill Nelson recommends Third Floor Heaven.
Third Floor Heaven.
From the first Bebop Deluxe album, Axe Victim.
All right, and then we can hear his guitar work on that and understand why you've chosen such a nobody to be the Axeman.
It's either him or Zal Clemenson.
Zal Clemenson, okay. Yeah. Okay, write him down. That's a great name, by the way, Zal Clemenson.
Yeah.
Who was in the sensational Alex Harvey Band. Band.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Okay, so what are we playing next? Oh.
Okay, so now the next track is by the late, great Nick Drake, and it's a track called At the Chime of a City Clock.
City freeze, get on your knees, pray for warmth and green paper. A city drought, you're down and out, I see your trousers don't taper. A saddle up, I kick your feet, I ride the range of a London street. I travel to a local plane, I turn around and come back again. And at the chime of a city clock, I put up your roadblock, I hang on to your crown. For a stone in a tin can is wealth to the city man who leaves his armor down.
talk with neighbors only. For games you play make people say you're either weird or lonely. A city star won't shine too far on account of the way you are and the beads around your face. Make you sure to fade back in grace. And at the beat of a city drum.
Okay, so that was At the Chime of a City Clock by Nick Drake, from his third album, Brighter Later. No, actually his second album, sorry. Second album, Brighter Later. Recorded in the sort of 1970 and released in 1971. Now, Nick Drake hardly sold any records during his lifetime. And when I first heard him, which was in the 80s, I think his stock couldn't have been at a sort of lower point, really. I don't think anybody really... I'd sort of kind of heard of him. Certainly nobody in my circle of friends. Mm. And I know that in the late 70s... there was a box set came out called Fruit Tree, which basically put together all his three albums plus his final recordings. But yeah, that's a beautiful song, and his songwriting and his guitar playing and voice are absolutely sort of superb on that. He's always seen as a sort of doomed kind of sort of figure. He died in 1974 from an overdose of antidepressants. Mm.
26
he was, yeah.
Unbelievably young.
But although, you know, most people sort of feel that he sort of committed suicide, a lot of other sort of contemporary reports say that he was actually starting to sort of come out of that depressive state. And it was more than likely an accident that he got up in the night and either forgotten he'd taken his original dose of tablets and took some more.
Poor sod.
Yes.
Whatever the cause of his death, whether it was deliberate or accidental, it was too early. And such a talent, such a wonderful... you were talking, as we were listening to that, about he's playing the guitar and singing at the same time, so they're not on separate tracks.
Yeah, I think he just played in the... he just played together, and in some of his recordings, he sort of played in the middle of on the first album, which is quite orchestrated. Mm. He played sort of with the orchestra in one big room.
Wow.
Yeah, towards the end of his life, when he was recording his last few tracks, he wasn't able to do that.
Oh.
So he played the guitar and then he'd sing over the top.
Right.
But when he was kind of sort of in fine fettle.
Yeah.
As he was on that album, which incidentally I think sold next to nothing.
It's astonishing that something that good is not revered. It's almost obscure. It's a travesty, really, because that is such a lovely thing.
Yeah.
He's got a very English folk voice.
Yeah.
Very. Do you know that song which opens Detectorists?
Oh yeah, Johnny Flynn. Yeah,
Johnny Flynn sounds. He's got a very similar style, I think, style of voice.
Yeah.
I suppose it goes without saying that we both rate Nick Drake very highly, but we have to do this efficiently.
Yeah.
Because you know there are government inspectors on our case if we get it wrong, or one day we'll be audited. Nick Drake, Jeremy Wall, is he overrated? Is he first rate, second rate, third rate, or fourth rate?
He's first rate.
He's first rate, isn't he, Nick Drake?
Easily.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a big influence on Robert Smith from The Cure.
Was he?
Apparently. And do you remember that song in the 80s, about 1985, called Life in a Northern Town?
Yes.
The Dream Academy?
Yes.
That's about him.
Is it?
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Really?
Apparently it is.
Okay. I know he's a big friend of another sort of singer-songwriter called John Martin.
Yes, John Martin.
Yeah, who wrote a song about him called Solid Air.
Okay.
Because he was very sort of I think Nick Drake was very sort of introverted.
Yeah, definitely.
So he could sort of disappear in a room, they said.
Yeah.
You know, and sort of, you'd only notice him when he was getting up to leave.
We were talking on, I think, the very first show about Judy Sill.
Judy Sill, yeah.
Who died young.
Yeah.
And was a singer-songwriter who wrote this kind of personal... and she was very introverted as well.
Yeah.
And he and her are of a kind, I would have thought. Who just don't really fit in a world that harsh, that environment of making music to sell to the masses.
Yeah, I mean,
with sharks at the heads of record studios and always an eye on the big hit and the sale. And
well, there's a documentary. I mean, his sister, Nick Drake's sister, Gabrielle, she talks on this documentary called... funnily enough, the documentary is called A Skin Too Few.
Oh, right.
And that's how she describes him.
Yeah.
That he kind of wasn't sort of strong enough for sort of the ups and downs of that sort of world. I mean, I know that he went out on his one and only tour and he came home early off of it because he would be playing places and people would be sort of, you know, as probably as a support act, and people would carry on sort of talking over the top of him, you know.
Yeah.
And there'd be a lot of pregnant pauses because he played with a lot of different sort of tunings, quite sort of intricate tunings, you know. So he was always like between songs retuning his guitar.
Yeah.
Didn't have a lot of stage patter or anything like
this
that.
This is not going to be a thrilling night for an audience, is it?
No, exactly, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And yeah, and he came home early from that and he didn't tour again. So part of his, I think one of the reviews of one of his records, the reviewer said that it's about time that he started getting something going for himself.
Right.
And I think what he meant by that is that, you know, you need to really, you get a record out, you need to back it up with touring
yourself,
or and I don't think he ever did.
Well,
that.
This is almost like the opposite of these pop star personas we were talking about. Your Adam Ants and Alvin Stardust, who were huge theatrical people.
Yeah.
Can you imagine Nick Drake is in the same sort of industry as what's his name, Alice Cooper?
Oh, yeah.
Alice Cooper is another rock pop star.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. Yeah.
And supposedly they're doing the same thing. They have the same job.
Yeah.
But Nick Drake is not cut out for this, is he? He's nowhere near equipped to deal with a world like that.
No.
Whereas Alice Cooper embraces it and makes a huge success of it.
Exactly, yeah.
And I would argue that Nick Drake's music is much more of merit than anything Alice Cooper has ever done, even though I've got nothing against Alice Cooper.
No. No, I mean, you know, it's a matter of
taste.
Not
often mentioned in the same breath, I would have thought, Nick Drake and Alice Cooper.
No, I wouldn't have thought so, no. And maybe that's a first.
Yeah.
And, like I said, you know, his stock couldn't have been sort of any lower, really, in that mid-80s
when you first
period.
Discovered it in the 80s, yeah.
Mid-80s, and I really love that track.
It is a very, very lovely track. The title track of the album, Brighter Later's, gorgeous. It's one of my favourite. I think of all the stuff I've heard from him. You gave me Pink Moon, I think, as well, to listen to.
Yeah, that's the third and final album.
I like that as well.
Yeah, that's quite bleak.
Yeah, it is a bit. Yeah, it's
just him, really, and his guitar and a little bit of a piano on a track.
It's not going to get you up on the dance floor, Jer.
No, it's not. No, well, nothing will.
No.
But that certainly won't. That track, funnily enough, that track, Pink Moon, is the. It was picked up by to advertise a car or something in the late 90s, and that's
when it plummeted.
No, and that's when people started noticing Nick Drake, and then you had a sort of they started re-releasing his stuff and people started getting interested in him, and he started getting sort of the recognition that he hadn't got during his lifetime.
None of you stand so tall, Pink Moon, and I get you on to Pink Moon.
Great, so the Beatles then, as always, the last song. Yes. And I chose the last one, which was We Can Work It Out, midway through the Beatles' career, I would have thought. This is getting on for 50 years now for the White Album.
Yeah.
A song you've chosen, which is?
It's Happiness Is a Warm Gun.
Right, well, let's hear it.
She's not a girl who misses much. Oh yeah. She's well acquainted with the touch of the velvet hand, like a lizard on a window pane. The man in the crowd with the multicolored mirrors on his hobnail boots, lying with his eyes while his hands are busy working overtime. A soap impression of his wife, which he ate and donated to the National Trust.
Right, Happiness Is a Warm Gun, which is on the Beatles double album, the White Album, or just called The Beatles. What track number is this?
It's somewhere? The last track on what would side one, if it was right. A vinyl copy.
So that starts with Back in the USSR.
Back in the USSR, Dear Prudence.
Yeah.
Obladi Oblada.
Oh God,
is it?
I don't know. But I'm starting an album with
It's Glass Onion.
Glass. Oh wow, that's a good song. Yeah. So starting an album with Back in the USSR and then ending the side with Happiness Is a Warm Gun. You can't argue with that, really, can you?
No.
So why have you chosen this song?
Because it's just one of the strongest songs on the album.
It is one of the strongest songs on the
it's,
album.
I've kind of been listening to the White Album for probably getting on for 40 years probably. And I remember just used to listen to it all the way through, you know, and enjoy putting everything on. But Happiness Is a Warm Gun, I just love the structure of it. I like Lennon's voice on it.
Yeah,
it's just got, for me, it's got everything, you know.
The White Album is the one album I struggle with. I've never loved it. I love basically all the others, but there's so many different moods and shifts of tone and songs that aren't very good.
Yeah,
I think for the first time on the White Album, but that is definitely one of the highlights. It's an amazing record. It just goes through so many different ideas and changes and tones in itself. It could be almost like an album, and it's not very long either. So
no.
From the beginning to the end, this journey you've gone on is quite. Let's go to McDonald.
Another song that is very similar in that sort. Another Lennon song in that sort of vein on the album is "I'm So Tired."
Yes.
Yeah, which is another great song.
That is great. Yeah.
Yeah.
One of his sleep songs. The other one being "I'm Only Sleeping."
Yeah. Yeah.
He's got his own sort of subgenre of songs about how knackered he is. Let's go to McDonald. We always quote him. Revolution in the Head. The Beatles Records and the 60s by Ian McDonald, the finest piece of fab scholarship ever published. And what he says about Happiness Is a Warm Gun, if I can pronounce some of his terminology, do excuse me. In the end, the more purely Lennonian aspect of Happiness Is a Warm Gun is in extreme ambiguity. From an initial mood of depression, it ascends through irony, self-destructive despair, and obscurely renewed energy to a finale that wrests exhausted fulfillment from anguish. Grippingly uneasy listening, the track's tense blend of sarcasm and sincerity stays unresolved until its final detumescent downbeat. I don't know what that means, but I'm in perfect agreement with it. It's a song that takes you on a little strange, epic, dark journey of its own. Lennon, very pointedly, for a liberal, was shocked at the notion of anybody enjoying shooting anything else, which is where the Happiness is a Warm Gun comes from. George Martin said that one of the things that always surprised him about Lennon was how naive he was. For a cynical man, that sometimes he would go up against the world and find it quite shocking. Whereas I think Martin had served through the war,
right,
and was much more worldly. And you have to remember how young they were, the Beatles. John, even though he was the most mature, most adult, most creative, most of the genius of the Beatles, was still, how old was he? About 26 or something?
What, in John White's album? He was 27. He might have just been, just hit 28 when it was released.
Unbelievable. And, you know, he was a very young newlywed, because he had to marry Cynthia, so, and he was on tour throughout the world, and seeing it for the first time, and he had to go through the whole, the Beatles are bigger than Jesus, furore in America. A lot of growing up happened, and yet there are still moments where he was shocked and aghast at the world, and Happiness is a Warm Gun is one of those expressions. I've got a Beatles question for you. I beat you last time, I think, didn't I?
I think so,
The first time.
Yeah.
Jeremy, my friend, very, very, very knowledgeable about the Beatles and all music generally. I've seven shows so far, and I've only managed to fox him once. Let's see, I've found a question for you. Okay. During the recording of which song did Ringo, which song on the White Album did Ringo walk out?
Dear Prudence?
No.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Okay.
Although, you're on the right track. Forgive the thing. He comes back to Dear Prudence. Well, apparently he didn't actually do the drums on it.
No, no, it's McCartney doing a Ringo impression. Is it Back in the USSR?
Yes, it is.
Is
good.
It? No, no, I mean, you've effectively stuffed me.
No, 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 I think you've got that. You got a second chance, and then you knew about Dear Prudence. No, I think we're going to give you that.
Do we know why he was?
Right, okay. Yeah. On the 22nd of August, during the session for Back in the USSR, Starr abruptly left the studio, feeling that his role in the group was peripheral, compared to the other members, and was upset at McCartney's constant criticism of his drumming on the track.
Yeah.
Because you would be, wouldn't you, if Macca was at you all the time.
Yeah.
In that kind of passive-aggressive, upward inflection voice, telling you that your drums weren't getting it, you'd throw sticks at him and tell him to piss off. Abbey Road staff later commented that Starr frequently turned up to the sessions and sat waiting in the reception area for the others to turn up. John was on heroin at this stage, so he was barely functional a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Plus Yoko was around.
Yeah.
Harrison was getting more and more into Indian mysticism and being reclusive. And Paul McCartney was a control freak, so couldn't have been fun. In his absence, McCartney played the drums on Dear Prudence. Lewison also reports that in the case of Back in the USSR, the three remaining Beatles each made contributions on bass and drums, with the result that those parts may be composite tracks played by Lennon, McCartney or Harrison. Lennon, McCartney and Harrison pleaded with Starr to reconsider, and he duly returned on the 5th of September. So how long was that? August to September, so only about a month away. To find his drum kit decorated with flowers, a welcome back gesture from Harrison. McCartney described the sessions for the Beatles as a turning point for the group, saying, "There was a lot of friction during that album." "Oh yeah, Paul, mainly from you, mate." "We were just about to break up, and that was tense in itself." While Lennon later said, "The breakup with the Beatles can be heard on that album. Of the album's 30 tracks, only 16 have all four band members performing."
Right, okay.
Most of them are kind of two or three on there. I think one of the tracks on there is just Paul, isn't it?
Blackbird, probably.
Probably Blackbird, yeah. Just him.
The thing is, you see, George Martin always said that he felt, I mean, because George Martin's involvement with that album is patchy as well.
He went on holiday, didn't he?
Yeah.
Conveniently.
Yeah, and he left it in, left...
Is it Jeff?
No, he left Chris Thomas in charge, who went on to produce Roxy Music.
And yes.
And Sex Pistols.
Oh.
Anyway, so he even said at the time that he felt that it would have made a very good single album.
Yeah.
And other people have levelled that as well. And in classic McCartney bullish form, well, you know, what do they know? It's the Beatles, you know, get over it. Yeah. He had that sort of attitude about
it. Which you can't blame him for, to be honest.
No. I mean, he's got fairly good... Got a point, yeah. Although, that is... The whole of pretty much the whole of side four being that sort of music, is it Music Concrete?
Yeah.
Experiment, yeah. Revolution number 9.
Which I adore, I must say.
You like that, yeah. I mean, I never used to switch that off when I was listening to the album when I first listened to it, and you'd have thought, as a sort of 10 year old or an 8 year old listening to that, number 9, yeah.
Number 9. Just because you can't get enough of Revolution number 9.
Yeah, I mean, it is slightly overindulgent, isn't it?
It's incredibly indulgent, yeah. But that's what art is, I think. We had this conversation before, haven't we? Maybe my band will be the overindulgent band.
Yeah.
And yours can be the hit makers, even though yours are all the obscurities and mine are all the superstars. Okay, then. So on this show, we've rated Nick Drake as first rate.
Yes.
Stevie Wonder as first rate.
Yeah.
The Monkees as first rate.
Yes.
Betty Boo, dear old Betty Boo, as third rate.
Yeah.
And is that it?
Yeah, and as always, the Beatles are unassailable.
Yeah, we can't rate the Beatles. What would you rate that song, though?
What Happiness is a Warm Gun?
Yeah.
First rate.
First rate, I'd have to agree. 2018 beckons. We'll be back next month. My name is Vince Staden.
I'm Jeremy Waugh.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, you can always say that, you know, say it's perhaps I'll go with, not definitely. I mean, in fact, I think it's a fine little album. I think the fact that it's got so much on it is one of the things that's cool about it, because they're very varied stuff, you know, Rocky Raccoon, Piggies, Happiness is a Warm Gun, that kind of stuff, you know. I think it's a fine album. You know, I'm not a great one for that. You know, maybe it was too many of that. Look, what do you mean? It was great. It sold. It's the bloody Beatles' White Album. Shut up.